This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm in Woodmead in Johannesburg today to welcome Ricardo Spagni, also known as Fluffy Pony, back to the podcast. In case you don't already know, Ricardo is the lead maintainer of the privacy-focused digital currency Monero and is one of the brains behind Atari, which is developing an open-source blockchain protocol built specifically for digital assets. Ricardo, it's a pleasure to chat to you again.
Thanks.
For the benefit of anyone who might have missed the announcement a bit earlier this year, just remind us what Atari is and the problem you guys are trying to solve.
Cool. So Atari is a decentralized assets protocol. So it focuses on providing a way for asset issuers to issue, transfer, and build out natively digital asset-based systems. So what is a natively digital asset? A natively digital asset are things like loyalty points, in-game assets, in-game tokens, security tokens, tickets. Mm-hmm. These are all things that are natively digital. So in other words, you don't need like a physical representation of it. Something that isn't a natively digital asset would be something like gold, where sure, you can have a token that represents gold, but the gold is a physical thing. So someone needs to store that physical thing somewhere, regardless of whether there's a token representing it or not. And we don't really believe in that as a use case. We're focused very much on these native digital assets. Mm-hmm. And we think that there's a lot of advantages to building this out in a decentralized way, and eventually in the future providing a platform where an asset issuer can say, like Emirates, for example, could say, I want to move my infrastructure from a centralized database where I have a walled garden for loyalty points, where all you can really buy with loyalty points are like flights and upgrades, to I want to issue those loyalty points in a decentralized way, where you can then take those loyalty points and use them to buy concert tickets or to buy assets for a game or whatever. And we think that there's an amazing future where people will be able to shift from one type of digital asset to another.
So the last time we spoke, you'd started building a team here in Johannesburg to develop Atari. Is that all in place now, and how's development going?
Good. So the team's still expanding. We have a lot on the go, and we're busy building as well. Mm-hmm. So we've spent a lot of time researching, talking with the community, and thinking about what the Atari protocol should look like. And we're in the process at the moment of working with the community to design a lot of the architecture. And we're doing this in a way that is decentralized. So we're not sort of saying, well, you know, he has the idea and he has how we're going to do it, and we just give it to the community and thrust it upon them.
Right.
But instead, we're saying to the community, you know, you guys are smart. You are, some of you are developers, some of you are users. How do you think we should build this out? And, you know, we've obviously got ideas, they've got ideas, and we're finding things that work and taking, taking in comments and criticisms from the broader community, which I think is really helpful.
So when will developers start to be able to play with a prototype of this?
It's going to be a while. So, you know, we're probably only going to break ground as we work through this architecture. We're probably only going to break ground on the code in the coming months. Mm-hmm. And I'd imagine we're anything from 12 to 18 months out from having, like, you know, some sort of test platform that asset issuers can start playing with.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk today about why, in your view, privacy matters online in crypto and blockchains and in our everyday lives. But before we get to that discussion, I must ask you about the meltdown we've seen in recent weeks in the crypto market. What do you make of it? Is it overdone?
So this is my fifth bear market in the crypto space. So, you know, by that point, you become kind of accustomed to it, and it's not even surprising anymore. It's like, oh, this is happening again. If you've been in the space for a short amount of time and this is your first bear market, which is entirely possible given that the last bull run before this one was 2013. So anyone who came in after 2013 will have entered during a bear market and then seen the bull run up to $20,000. And if this is your first crash, then you're going to go like, oh, no, the sky is falling. But, you know, when it's your fifth, you start to see a trend. And this is not a trend that's unique to Bitcoin or unique to crypto. This often happens with sharp stock movements where a stock will hit an all-time high. Then there'll be some scandal or whatever, or just, you know, the market gets a little bit uneasy and then there's a crash. And it tumbles down, but it tumbles down and settles above its previous all-time high. And then when it climbs again, it climbs, you know, back up, like beyond its previous highs. So, you know, this is not a trend that is unique to Bitcoin. It's not a trend that hasn't played out before. Not to say that what happens in the past is necessarily an indicator of what will happen in the future. But, you know, if we've been through this five times, we're probably going to go through this another bunch of times.
I was about to ask, you think this is history repeating itself? We're going to see the same thing again.
It definitely feels like that. I don't think the sky is falling. I think Bitcoin is still trying to figure out its price, or, you know, the market's trying to figure out Bitcoin's price. And I think we're at a point where right now, if you look at Bitcoin's emission, there's still 12.5 Bitcoin that's being emitted per block. And we're still quite far away. I mean, we're several decades away from that dropping down to a value that is so insignificant that fees are greater than the block reward. And so given that the block reward is still such a significant chunk of mining income, Bitcoin is still largely a currency that has a high rate of inflation relatively, and so price discovery is hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like there's a sub 1% rate of inflation where price discovery is a lot easier. So you've got a high rate of inflation, you've got this massive volatility because there's a rational exuberance and everyone thinks they're getting rich, and so because of that you're going to have highs and lows. And the swings are going to be extreme. But I think if you look at it over a macro time scale and you sit it out for the next 10, 15, 20 years, then we're going to see price discovery happening on a much more realistic basis. And I don't know what that price is going to be, you know, but it's certainly not going to be $3,500 or $4,000. I think we're going to settle on a much higher price as that inflation drops down and as Bitcoin's true utility becomes more apparent.
The volatility is incredible. And I mean, if you look at the movements, and you mentioned you compared it to equities and overinflated stock prices. If you look at the NASDAQ, for example, which went into a bubble around 2000 and then it crashed, it took 15 years to recover that same position. The sort of nadir to peak in the cryptocurrency world seems to be much more compressed.
Oh, yeah. Totally. I mean, like from Bitcoin's high of $1,200 in December 2013 to the recovery back to that height was 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very quick time. And previous movements have been much faster. You know, like some of them have been like 2 months. Mm-hmm. So 3.5 years is like the longest bear market that we've had. And that's, I think those periods will probably start to get longer and longer as the movement shifts. But at the same time, you've got this halving of the block reward every 4 years, which is a factor that something like a stock or, you know, or any sort of equity doesn't really have. So that change in the amount of new supply is really interesting, because even if demand stays constant throughout that period, the reduction in supply affects things. And then you've got you've got this reduction in supply, and you know, again, even if demand stays static, you've got people going like, I'm not going to sell my coins, I'm going to hodl them, because a hodl mentality is a big thing. And if they hold on to their coins and they don't sell them, then that basically just reduces the effective supply even more. And so you've just got this constant like hammering down on the new supply and the existing supply, and again, you know, regardless of whether demand stays flat or increases, it's going to have that volatile movement and that upward pressure on the market overall.
I've seen a few local economists in recent weeks arguing that the volatility is a major problem for the adoption of Bitcoin as a means of transacting, that no one is actually going to use this to make purchases if the volatility is so extreme. You need a much more stable currency. What's your take on that?
I think, you know, as the markets become more mature, and as the people, clever traders, start closing a lot of the gaps between markets through arbitrage, then we're going to start to see some stability. But I also am not convinced that that stability is anytime soon. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we're probably like anything from 5 to 15 years out from going, okay, Bitcoin's price is relatively stable. Or at least doesn't have these wild swings like a teenager throwing a tantrum. And we'll see, like when we get to that, then it makes a lot more sense for Bitcoin to operate like a currency than it does now.
Yeah. So are we looking at 10 to 15 years before things like Bitcoin become a real alternative to fiat currencies?
So I think yes and no. You know, a real alternative to fiat currencies or buying a cup of coffee, yes, we're probably looking at 10 to 15 years out, unless, you know, you want your coffee to cost $2.50 today and $10 tomorrow. but as a settlement option, then I think that's very different. And so, you know, settlement could be, I'm buying stock from overseas and importing it, and I need to pay my suppliers. My suppliers don't care that much about volatility, because the volatility tends to happen over a, you know, several day period or whatever. So if I pay them and they convert it immediately from Bitcoin to their local fiat currency, then what difference does it make? Bitcoin just becomes a carrier for that settlement.
But I suppose it's Bitcoin becomes or has become a powerful currency when you're doing that transaction and you're not immediately converting it to fiat.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, as a settlement carrier, it's perfectly fine if there's volatility. Mm-hmm. You're right that there's a lot of power once you have a circular economy. So once my supplier can pay their staff in Bitcoin and pay their rent in Bitcoin and so on, and pay their taxes in Bitcoin, it becomes a lot more powerful.
Yeah.
And that, again, helps with the price discovery. But between then and now, it's still very useful for things like I want to send unstoppable transactions. You know, I want to be able to send money overseas. I'm perfectly happy to comply with local legislation, but I don't see why that local legislation should mean that the bank holds my money and, you know, has an impact on what I do with my money. Mm. I should be able to do whatever I want with my money, then comply with legislation after the fact.
Yeah. So before we move on and start to talk about privacy, just a last question around this. You've been through 5 of these cycles now. Do you think we're at the bottom of the bear market now?
That's a good question. So I was on CNBC a few months back. I mean, this is like not recent, when we just dropped down to like, I think we just hit like $8,000 or $7,000 or $8,000, mm-hmm. and I sort of said like I have an expectation that we're going to go down to like $4,000 or so. That was my expectation then. It's still my expectation. I'm not a trader. I don't believe in technical analysis any more than I believe in crystal healing, mm-hmm. and I don't really understand the market. But I just based on like my absolute thumbsuck guess. 4,000 is sort of roughly what I would have expect the bottom to be at.
And nothing's changed since then.
Yeah. And that's not to say that it won't dip below it for periods of time, but I think that sort of $4,000 mark is a reasonable approximation for the bottom. It would be odd for me to see Bitcoin go much below that, to see it go all the way to say $1,000. That's not to say it won't, but
what do you base it on? I mean, why would you say $4,000?
I base that on the same thing I base my belief in crystal healing on. it's total guesswork. It's just it's based on my observation in previous bear cycles, mm-hmm. And seeing like you know, like when we climbed up to $100 and then, you know, went back down to 45 or whatever. You know, like sort of feeling that out from previous cycles, it's my guess. But it is a guess. I might be dead wrong, you know, and maybe Bitcoin goes down to $200 tomorrow.
So this is not financial advice, folks.
This is not, yeah, please don't swing trade on, please don't use crystal healing, and please don't swing trade on Ricardo's estimates.
Right, so privacy.
Yes.
You're a member of the core team that develops and maintains Monero, which is a truly anonymous cryptocurrency. I know we've spoken about this before, but perhaps a quick refresher would be good. How does Monero work, and how is it different to Bitcoin?
Cool. So I believe there are six pillars to privacy. The first is you want to be able to hide where a transaction is coming from. The second is you want to be able to hide where a transaction is going to. The third is you want to be able to hide the amount you're transacting. The fourth is you want to be able to hide the IP address, so the computer's address for where the transaction originated from. The fifth is you want to have mandatory privacy so that you have a maximal privacy set. And the sixth is you want to have a strong ideology behind the development of that privacy. And Monero tries to fulfill all of these. Mm-hmm. To a greater or lesser degree than some other attempts. It does really well with things like hiding where you're paying. So you can't deduce the Monero address that is being paid by a transaction. It does really well with hiding the amount that you're paying. You can't guess the amount that's being paid in a Monero transaction. It does really well with regards to mandatory privacy, so having a maximal privacy set. It does really well with ideology. The Monero developers, and there are a lot of them, there have been over 500 people that have worked in the Monero project over the past 4.5 years. And they all, by and large, are not doing it for money or financial gain. They're doing it for a genuine interest in advancing privacy in the privacy-enhancing landscape.
Libertarians.
I think to some degree, yes. Not all of them are libertarians. There are some people who are straight-up capitalists. There's some people who are anarcho-capitalists. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's some people who are more traditional libertarians. I mean, there are some people who even think that privacy is not something that is indistinguished or necessarily at odds with government. I certainly believe that... you know, you shouldn't pit the one against the other, that you can have financial privacy and still have good police work and, you know, have a government that is able to generally govern its people in an okay way. Mm. I don't think they're at odds with each other. So, yeah, there's a wide range of beliefs that are held by the Monero community. It's not a bunch of people, you know, with like down with the man tattoos on their back or whatever.
So what are people using Monero for mainly?
That's a good question.
You don't really know.
Yeah, I was going to say, the thing with the privacy currency is you don't really know. You shouldn't be able to tell. If you can tell, then you're doing it wrong. When I'm faced with this question in the past, I sort of quite flippantly say tax evasion. but it's because we don't know. So that's my best guess. You know, I don't know what people are using it for. I just assume tax evasion.
But working in the community, you must have a feel for what's happening in terms of people are buying with it.
Mariah Carey accepts Monero on an online store.
Oh, wow.
So do the Backstreet Boys. So if it's not tax evasion, then it's Mariah Carey and Backstreet Boy mugs.
There we go. What's the volatility? I haven't looked at Monero's price. What's the market cap now, and how's it done in this recent sell-off?
I tend to not look at prices at all during the bear market, I have no idea.
Everything's been sold off.
Yeah.
So why, Ricardo, is anonymity important? And by the same token, why is privacy important?
So I don't know. I mean, anonymity and privacy are two different things. Mm-hmm. You can be a person who is known, who transacts using their real identity, and still be a private person. And so wealthy people have largely gotten this right for a long time. A lot of them put their assets behind companies and so on. And they don't do that necessarily is a way of paying less tax, although sometimes that is a benefit. Mm-hmm. But they often do that so that you can't go and go to the deeds office and look up someone's name and go, oh, wow, this guy owns 30 properties. You know, it's an extra layer just to make sure that their stuff remains private, that their assets and their wealth remain private. And Bitcoin is an incredibly powerful currency, but the reality is that this aspect of privacy and fungibility is not something that was important during Bitcoin's design and creation, or at least it was less important than it probably should have been. And as a result, you have this this incredibly powerful, censorship-resistant digital currency where if you go and pay for something with it, the person you're paying can see how much money you have. And that's not ideal. You know, it's like going to Checkers and buying a Coke and, you know, when you swipe your card, it shows your bank balance to the cashier. Like, that's just not ideal. It's not the way that we want to transact. And there are people certainly who are working on privacy enhancing tools for Bitcoin, but I think that that's a long way away from any meaningful privacy on Bitcoin. And so Monero exists to fill that gap in the meantime, and potentially for forever, to provide privacy, financial privacy, provide a tool for that, because I think that privacy should be a basic human right.
So there's an interesting statistic that I've seen you share before. You say that when the average consumer uses PayPal to pay a merchant in Europe, say, their data goes to 600 companies. Is that true?
Yeah. So there's a GDPR and some of the other European regulations. Mm-hmm. Let us query the information query companies about what they're doing with our data. Mm. And so there's a researcher who went and queried PayPal and ended up getting this list of 600 plus companies and organizations that get your data when you use PayPal in Europe. And that is frightening because some of those organizations, I mean, you know, it's like law enforcement and that, and you can sort of go like, okay, well, yeah, I guess law enforcement maybe needs my PayPal data, I don't know. But then there's other companies on there which are like marketing and analytics companies, and you don't know if they're paying for your data or getting it for free. You know, I'd probably prefer if they paid for my data. You know, at least someone's getting rich off it. But it's still frightening to know that 600 companies, 600 plus companies, know that I bought whatever, a dog bowl on eBay. I mean, like, it's fine when you're buying stuff that's arbitrary, but what happens when you go use that to buy medication? There's lots of online pharmacies in Europe. And now you've got 600 plus companies who know that you have this particular condition or disease or whatever.
Which you don't want anyone else
which
to know.
Which you don't want anyone else to know, yeah. Some of that stuff is like I highly sensitive. Mm-hmm. What about when you make a donation to a political party? Now you've got 600 plus companies and you're expecting them to keep that donation private? I mean, this is like, you know, Equifax couldn't keep social security numbers private. I mean, like, how do we expect 600 plus companies to keep our spending habits private? Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. All you need is one rogue employee at one company to go like, you know, I'm pissed off with the world and I'm leaking this information.
So how do we as consumers take back control over our own data? Most of us are quite happy to share incredibly personal information on Facebook without ever even reading Facebook's terms and conditions and understanding what it does with that data.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, who the hell reads terms and conditions anyway? Should we even be using social platforms like Facebook in your view?
So I think that there's steps that we can take. I'm never going to say to someone like, don't use Facebook or whatever, because they're not going to listen to me if I tell them that. And there's a general apathy towards privacy. So people are largely, as you said, happy to give all the information over to Facebook as long as they can play Farmville.
Yes.
And you're not going to get that hook away from them. You know, people want to post their pictures on Instagram so that they can get likes and followers because that's the validation that they need about their picture of their lunch. And it's just straight up human psychology that social media is playing into. And you can't fault them for wanting to create a good product and make a bunch of money. And security and privacy plays a secondary role there. I think that we can be smarter, though, as humans if we want to take back control of our privacy. So as an example, you want to post pictures up on Instagram, no problem. Why do you need to post them live? You know, like, why do you need to tell the criminals that you're at the movie right now?
Mm-hmm.
It's silly. Why not just delay that post? You've taken a photo of you and your friends at the movies.
Because you know, people want instant gratification.
Well, that's it. They want the world to know, and it's so silly. Wait until you're home to post it.
Mm.
Post it the next morning. Don't post a picture of your breakfast at Tasha's Morningside Live.
Mm.
You know, don't let people know where you are, when you are, and what you're doing, because it's unnecessary leaking of metadata. And I mean, if you really want to take it to the extreme, then you can even go the opposite and, like, you know, post that picture at Tasha's the next morning. No one's going to know that you're not there right now.
Mm.
You know, so you can filter out the bleed of information by just changing your posting habits. And that alone makes a big difference. Same goes for people with kids. Think carefully about who has access to the pictures that you're posting of your children. I'm sure your children are lovely and terribly photogenic, but do you need to have 300 million photos of them on Facebook for everyone to have access to? There's all sorts of pedophiles and weird people out there that are using those photos for purposes that you do not intend.
Mm.
But as a parent, you're just uploading that stuff because, you know, your mom is on Facebook and she wants to see photos of her grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we just exercise the tiniest bit of self-control and go, I'm going to send these photos to my mom over WhatsApp instead of posting them up on Facebook, it would just make the world a slightly better place.
Mm.
And you would take back a little bit of control over your private information.
And no one really cares about your kids' photos anyway.
You know, I didn't want to say it.
So you're hyper-connected. How do you deal with your personal security online? I mean, what instant messaging app do you use, for example? Do you use Signal?
So I spend a lot of time compartmentalizing.
Mm-hmm.
There are places where, like, I use Telegram, for example, a lot, and I treat everything that I send over Telegram as extremely not private at all.
Right.
Because Telegram's not very good at protecting user privacy.
What about Signal?
So Signal's slightly better. The problem with Signal is you have to give over your phone number. So now you end up being part of a social graph.
Right.
So I prefer Wire, because you can create a Wire account that isn't linked to a phone number.
Uh-huh.
And Wire is really powerful that way. I mean, like, you can take it to an extreme. You can use OTR over IRC if you really want to go, like, reasonably secure pretty well encrypted.
Mm.
But I think for most people, WhatsApp is largely fine. WhatsApp and iMessage, if you have an iPhone, use end-to-end encryption. The big trick with something like WhatsApp is you have to turn on those notifications for a person's security code being changed,
mm-hmm.
which is hidden in the WhatsApp settings menu. And then if the person gets a new phone, it'll show a little message that says, this person's security code has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can phone them up and be like, hey, did you get a new phone? And if they say no, then something odd is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And chances are it's unlikely that someone is going to try and, like, hijack someone else's WhatsApp account to try and do anything. But just knowing that that's what happens gives you incredible power, because now you go, oh, that's weird. My spouse's WhatsApp code has changed. You know, like, maybe nothing's going on, and maybe someone's hijacked their WhatsApp account so they can say, honey, I'm stuck at the airport in Kuala Lumpur and I need you to send me money via Western Union.
Yeah.
And since you're empowered to understand that and to understand that getting that notification about their security code being changed means something, you're now able to have, like, this out-of-band confirmation that something's gone on.
And in most cases, people won't check. But I suppose if you're a journalist, for example, dealing with a source who can't be compromised, then seeing that information is critical.
Absolutely. And even, you know, like people get scammed in the stupidest ways all the time. And so just empowering yourself by understanding the tools that you use is something that would immediately avoid or destroy, like, 50%, 80% of scams.
Yeah. I want to ask about governments. Should we be trusting them? I mean, it's interesting what's going on in China now, where the Communist Party plans to mine people's data and give them online ratings. That sounds pretty Orwellian to me. Can we be certain that Western democracies are not going to try the same thing or something similar?
I think that we have several thousand years of evidence that mankind is really bad at governing itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you just need to look at the history books to confirm that. I have yet to meet someone that argues otherwise, that says, no, we're really good at governing ourselves. Here's an example, the United Kingdom. We're really bad at it. and as time goes on, we just seem to be getting worse at it. You know, we're like, oh, democracy will save us. And then Trump becomes president. We're not very good at it. And so should we be trusting governments? I think that that a lot of people in government try to do good.
Yeah.
I don't think that people in government are inherently evil. But I think that there are so many things out of their control that despite their best intentions, they just often can't solve everything and they can't fix everything. And so it's not really a matter of trusting government or not trusting government. It's a matter of just practically going, even if I do trust them, there's only so much that they can do.
Yeah.
And they often have to deal with private companies and institutions, and they have to share your information or, you know, whatever with those private companies. And those companies also, you know, again, I don't think they're inherently evil, but history has shown us that they're just not very good at securing our data.
We a couple of years ago, obviously, we had the Edward Snowden revelations, and we saw how the NSA and organizations like GCHQ were hoovering up the internet, basically,
yeah.
Plugging their systems directly into undersea cables and hoovering up all the information that they possibly could. Isn't that not evil?
So, you know, again, it comes down to, like, what are they trying to accomplish? In their minds, and it's really difficult as a privacy advocate to do this, but if you can just put yourself in their shoes for a second. They think the best way to prevent terrorism and, you know, large-scale abuse is to just have absolute access to information and be able to control things. And I guess in some ways it's probably like being a parent. You know, I mean, if you're a parent, and I'm not a parent, so I'm only speaking from, you know, as an external observer, but if you're a parent, I'm sure that it is very difficult to let your child go to school in an environment which is completely uncontrolled, where there are a bunch of other kids that might be feeding them all sorts of nonsense, that might be showing them all sorts of stuff online, and not want to control that. But I mean, how do you control it? You know, do you lock your kid at home, they're never allowed to go out, and you're going to do homeschooling? I mean, that doesn't seem ideal. They're going to end up with like zero social skills. But I mean, it must be natural to have that desire to want to control the environment around the child to prevent it from learning about all the horrible things in the world too quickly, or to prevent it from having bad things happen to it. And so I look at that and I think to myself, governments are trying to do the same. They're just trying to protect their citizens.
Nanny statism.
Yes. That in their minds, that's what they're trying to do. But unfortunately, what it's become is them trying to prevent abuse by being the abusers. And that's just not an ideal world to live in.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff. We are unfortunately out of time. Ricardo Spagni is co-founder of Tari and lead maintainer of the Monero project. It's always great to have you on your show. Thank you. On our show, thank you for the time.
thank you
for
much.
Your time.
Thank you for having me.